Support for this podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Turn shipping to your advantage with USPS Ground Advantage service. Learn how to gain a competitive edge at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the very latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. As you may have noticed, a few of our podcast episodes have the phrase, "if you can keep it," in the headline. Well, we're excited to officially announce the new series running weekly leading up to the election. With me in studio is a voice you're very familiar with, 1A's Todd Zwillick. He'll join us every Monday. And Todd, the name of the series was actually your idea.
Yeah, when we were planning this series, it's great to be with you, Jen. Thanks. That phrase, "if you can keep it," it actually goes back to a man named James McHenry. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, 1787. He was writing in his journal about the very last day of the Constitutional Convention in September. And he wrote in his journal this phrase, that a lady, who incidentally was a Mrs. Powell of Philadelphia, asked Dr. Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And the doctor replied, "A republic, ma'am, if you can keep it." That's the origin of the phrase. And we chose it because with this series, we want to focus on the election. We want to put the polls and the horse race really to the side. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this on the show. Mm-hmm. And we want to focus on the stakes of this election for voters, for our communities, and especially for our democracy. And that's where we get to the theme that we have this republic. If you can keep it, that's what this election is all about, and that's what we want our coverage to focus on.
That's right. So today we head to Georgia, where President Biden and presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump held dueling campaign rallies over the weekend.
Folks, it's not hyperbole to suggest our freedoms are literally on the ballot this November. Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans are trying to take our freedoms away.
They talk about the beautiful dream of migrants. It sounds so nice, you know, like in a fairy tale book. But some of these people are monsters.
Georgia holds its presidential primary tomorrow, but there's lingering legal trouble for former President Trump in Georgia for his efforts to overturn the result of the last presidential election. Where does Georgia's case against Trump stand? And with the presidential primary tomorrow, what can Georgia tell us about the general election and the state of our democracy more broadly? I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Joining us from Atlanta is George Chidi. He's the politics and democracy reporter for The Guardian. He also uncovered the Trump campaign's so-called fake elector scheme in Georgia. Welcome to the program, George.
Happy to be here. Thank you very much.
And also with us from Atlanta is NPR political reporter Stephen Fowler. Stephen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Todd, Georgia is a swing state. It's also a focal point for Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. And we'll talk more about that later. But give us some context about why it's important to watch this state closely this go around.
The quintessential swing state, of course. I mean, we're not going to learn a whole lot tomorrow about who the candidates are. I think we're pretty sure at this point,
right.
Donald Trump versus Joe Biden in the rematch that a lot of people say they don't want. But Georgia is super important. You just mentioned it. It was ground zero for the effort to steal the election in 2020 on a lot of different dimensions. We'll talk about fake electors in more than one state. By the way, fake electors are charged in Georgia, have also been charged in Nevada, have been charged in Michigan. There's a grand jury convened in Arizona on the fake elector scheme. Also, the intimidation of election workers. We'll hear more about that. People are familiar with the intimidation of Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss. They are not alone. Election workers in Fulton County, up to the leadership of Fulton County, faced threats, and I think they probably continue to today. Georgia, finally, I'll say, is very important and interesting because it is a prime example of the dynamic that I think helped lead the most to intimidation of election workers and efforts to undermine faith in the election. Fulton County and other counties around Atlanta, a large urban area, lots and lots of, in this case, black voters in an otherwise red state. That's a pretty similar dynamic to places like Michigan with Wayne County, Arizona with Maricopa County, even to an extent Pennsylvania, even though there's two major urban centers, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And it shows how the strategy, as far as we know it, worked there to try to undermine faith, operation of the election in the major urban centers where, in this case, many black voters were voting, where a lot of Democratic voters were voting, and try to tip that purple state in the favor of Donald Trump. So that's why it's so critical to watch, because the voting dynamics remain the same.
Well, Stephen, both Trump and Biden were at rallies in Georgia over the weekend. What were their messages to voters?
Well, the messages were largely the same messages that we've seen for the past 4 years. I mean, Donald Trump has taken on this tone in the 2024 campaign cycle that's a little bit more dire, saying, you know, if you do not elect me, we won't have an America to continue. Joe Biden, too, also said democracy is on the ballot in Georgia and the rest of the country in 2024. I was at the Biden rally. It was a smaller, intimate setting. And, you know, he really made the case that Georgia helped him become president in 2020, and with their support, would do it again in 2024. At the Trump rally, there was a lot of message, Georgia-specific messages. We had Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene speak beforehand, Georgia Congressman Mike Collins speak beforehand. And so at this point, you know, each president has won Georgia once before. They hope to do it again. But, you know, to Todd's point, what I'm looking at and what I'm thinking about is there is some stuff under the hood that shows the weakness each candidate has coming into November will be on full display in Georgia both tomorrow and in the next 8 months.
Now, Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis charged Trump and 18 of his allies with conspiring to overturn his 2020 loss in Georgia. Four of those defendants have already pleaded guilty, Stephen. What's the latest with that case?
Well, it is going on and on and on and on. You know, one thing about having this many people charged is that there are tons of legal procedures. There's motions to dismiss, motions to cut out part of the indictment. Right now, we're in the middle of a motion to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis and her office from the case brought by several of the defendants that has gone into this sort of side quest conversation about the romantic life of District Attorney Willis and conflict of interest and allegations of being personally enriched by going after Trump and all of these other people. So the short answer is it's still going on and not going on anywhere fast. I mean, originally, a long time ago, there was the district attorney's office had hoped to bring this to trial before the 2024 election. But with the disqualification efforts and everything else going on, you know, for those people that didn't take plea deals, you know, they'll be lucky if this case gets heard by next year.
Stephen, are we due to hear a ruling on Fani Willis and her potential disqualification soon? I mean, that's supposed to be any day now, right?
It should be any day now. There were tons of live broadcast, kind of tawdry hearings going into Fani Willis's relationship with one of the top prosecutors brought on to help the case. She said they began a relationship after he was hired, and it ended before the indictments against Trump and others were brought. But we saw all sorts of testimony about cash reimbursements for vacations and allegations of improper affairs and just all sorts of stuff that's really more like a Lifetime movie rather than a criminal court case dealing with the former president of the United States. But with this mountain of evidence and with the implications for it, this case going beyond, okay, does this person go to trial or not, Judge Scott McAfee, who's been very even-handed taking care of all of this, has said that he should have a ruling soon.
Now, George, you've been reporting from the Atlanta courthouse for many years, and you actually uncovered Trump's fake electors plot. Just briefly recap exactly what the plot was.
So the idea there was that Georgia Republicans would put a slate of electors up against the Democratic electors who had actually won the state in order to create a pretext for then Vice President Pence to throw everybody's electors out and then ultimately to throw the election into the House of the Representatives. But in conjunction with all of the other acts of, you know, alleged interference, it, you know, looks like a plot. And they were operating in secret, which I think is important. They didn't want anybody to know what they were doing at the time. I got lucky and managed to find them in the Capitol on that day. But
give us a little insight into how you were tipped off that something was happening.
So it wasn't so much that I was tipped off. I noticed an anomaly when I was at the state Capitol on the December 24th, 2020. An old friend of mine, a young man who would have been one of the Republican electors if the Republicans had won, passed me in the hall without acknowledging me. And I've known him since he was 13, and he went into a room. And I thought, oh, well, you guys must be up to something. So I went in with a camera. Often, like good journalism is simply a product of recognizing, when something is wrong.
You know, Todd, you mentioned some of the other states in the country where this fake electors scheme was unfolding. We are now in another presidential election year. And have we done anything, either at the state or the federal level, to sort of shore up the places where schemes like this have a little wiggle room to work their way through? Have we closed any of those gaps?
At the state level, largely no. At the national level, somewhat. The Congress finally, after many, many, many tries, changed the law that governs January 6th, that governs the procedure in the House of Representatives that Trump and his allies effectively, evidently, were trying to exploit. Through the Electoral Count Act, which is an old and ancient law, it's now harder to do the objections on the floor. It's harder to abuse the procedure. It's not impossible. I have referred to this as the Trump-shaped hole in election law that Congress has largely patched for the last plot, for the last way it was done. Could it be done in a different way? The Supreme Court actually opened up some troubling questions with the 14th Amendment ruling, a conversation for another day. But what's especially important, I think, about Georgia's story is how this was indeed a plot. We have learned so much about how lawyers for Trump, including familiar names like Ken Chesbro, unfamiliar names like Jim Troupas, another lawyer in Wisconsin, who we just learned in the last week were emailing all over the place and had decided that the fake elector plot would basically be the order of the Trump campaign as early as November 8th, right after the election. They got the ball rolling to use a fake elector plot in Georgia, Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, on down the list. This was the plan from the beginning. We've learned so much more about it.
As we said in January, an attorney for one of the defendants in the case against Trump alleged that Fulton County DA Fonnie Willis had a romantic relationship with one of the prosecutors she hired, Nathan Wade. George, how has this affected the case against Trump in Georgia?
So I think there's a meaningful question about when this is going to be resolved. And we're not going to know how that moves forward until we hear the ruling from Judge McAfee about whether or not Fonnie Willis is still on this case. If she's lifted, this will go to a state prosecutor's counsel who will choose another prosecutor. And that prosecutor, if it's somebody from outside of the metro Atlanta area, is likely to be a Republican. And almost certainly, regardless of whether or not they're a Republican or a Democrat, will probably have to reinvestigate elements of the case. If Nathan Wade if his work is discounted in the process of removing Fonnie Willis, they'll have to start over. And if they have to start over, there's almost no chance that this goes to trial and is completed before the November election.
Stephen, how much do you think this is distracting from the actual charges against Trump?
Well, I mean, I think some of that is the intention. Obviously, the defense attorneys for the people charged have the goal of getting charges against their clients dismissed. And for once, you could say that Donald Trump's lawyers are very, very well accomplished in that regards. He's got a high-profile defense attorney kind of helping him to try to get out of the trouble that his non-good attorneys did in the aftermath of the 2020 election. But this is almost more important in the court of public opinion than what's going on in the actual court docket. You have wall-to-wall coverage of every single development in this case, every allegation, every filing, because unlike some of the other cases against Trump, all of the proceedings are live streamed on YouTube, and there's pool cameras in there broadcasting every single filing and every single witness that shows up. And so there's kind of this trial within a trial, which is more about the character of all of these parties involved. And through these allegations and the revelations of this relationship, it has become less about the charges against Donald Trump and his allies and their attempt to overturn the election, and a bit more about the character of the lawyers bringing the case and the lawyers representing the defendants.
George, you know, we talk so much about how this case will affect politics in Georgia. How are politics affecting the case? I mean, Judge McAfee has just drawn a challenger for his next election, right? A Democrat is now challenging the judge. And also, Republicans in the Georgia legislature have begun an investigation to try to make news out of the challenge of Fani Willis. I mean, the politicians are all over this one.
I find it fascinating that a meaningful element of what we've been hearing over the last month involves lawyers talking to other lawyers. The Ashley Merchant, who is representing the defendant that brought this Fani Willis romantic thing to light, was testifying in front of a Senate panel about text messages she was getting from one of the other witnesses who was, you know, on the stand over the course of the last couple of weeks. And I'm looking at that like, you know, at what point, like, we have to care about what the attorneys are communicating to one another. It's an extremely unusual situation in a court that's got a lot of unusual situations going on in it, even aside from the Trump case. The one thing I keep telling people is that the justice system itself is on trial here. The ability for the powers that be to hold someone who is powerful to account is in question as we are looking at this. And it's been fascinating.
All right, let's head to a quick break. Still to come, we hear from the elections director in Cobb County, Georgia. She says she's been doxxed online by right-wing groups spreading misinformation. Back with more in a moment.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator for Planet Money podcast on NPR.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to the conversation and add another voice. Joining us from Marietta, Georgia is Tate Fall. She's the elections director for Cobb County, Georgia, which is just outside Atlanta. Tate, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tate, just describe your duties as elections director.
Sure. So I've been in this position for just over 3 months. I moved from Arlington, Virginia, where I was the deputy director. So we're the third largest jurisdiction here in Georgia. We have just over 500,000 voters. So I lead a staff of permanent employees, about 57, that do everything from early voting, absentee by mail, setting up the precincts, equipment, poll worker training, you name it, we do it all here. So my job is just to coach this amazing team that I have here.
So 3 months on the job, why did you decide to make this move?
I wanted to get closer to family. That was our first priority. But also, I wanted, you know, it's hard to find director jobs. They don't come open very often. We've seen a lot more in the last couple years than we ever had before. You just had to kind of wait for someone to retire. So I knew that when the right job opened up, I loved being in Arlington. But when the right job opened up, we wanted to move back south and get closer to our family. And Cobb was a dream job for me. So when it opened up, I just jumped at the opportunity.
Well, Tate, I know that you're aware that election workers and officials around the country facing intimidation, disinformation, even threats is basically an epidemic now. Thousands have left their jobs in jurisdictions all over the country, including Texas, Nevada, Arizona, lots of cases that we're aware of. Georgia is ground zero for this type of behavior. How has that affected your personal security, how you're thinking through security for your staff, and really your desire to take on this job?
Sure. So security is always top of mind for me when I'm at the office, when I'm at home. I was in D.C. for January 6th, so I am always thinking about how the situation could turn. So we did have CISA with the Department of Homeland Security come out to our facility here and do a security check, and they gave us recommendations of things that I haven't even thought of, like putting bomb-resistant film on windows to help reduce glass if there was a bomb to go off. And so there's things like that, panic buttons, silent alarms, all of these things that we're putting in to our facility here. We're separate from the rest of the county facilities, so we're kind of on our own. So that's something that we do here. We also added de-escalation training to our poll worker training. We were getting lots of questions and concerns about those interactions. And I think definitely saw this election being harder to staff. Hearing from my area supervisors, it was people's concern about safety and about the interactions they would have with voters.
Tate, I have to say, it's stunning to hear you describe some of the safety measures you're taking around one of the fundamental parts of our democracy, elections, having them be free and fair. Considering your commitment to this job, how are you wrapping your mind around the fact that that is also part of the responsibilities you have to take on now?
I think it's just a part of the service. I come from a military family, and so service is something that was ingrained in me at a young age. And on my hardest days, I ask myself, if not me, then who? And if we all take a step back, who's going to take a step forward? So I studied elections at Auburn. I knew I wanted to do election administration since grad school. And it truly is an honor every day to serve my voters. I have long conversations with people that are heated, trying to bring them back down to what actually is happening here in Cobb. And I always tell my voters, I serve you the same whether you trust me or not. That doesn't change what I do and how we do it, how we all do it here in Cobb and in Georgia. Every elections office is committed. And when we have tours, when we have people come in, they see these are your neighbors. These are people that are in the pickup line with you. These aren't foreign actors or people sent down from, you know, a campaign. These are your neighbors, and they are here because they love what they do and they care about democracy.
Considering some of the additional planning you're doing, do you feel your office is properly staffed and funded?
I think we could always use more funding. That's always a hard piece. We pay an exorbitant amount in temp worker and overtime work. And that's tough. That's difficult. We have people who are seasonal employees that hold key positions within our processes, because a staff of 57 sounds like a lot, especially when I came from Arlington where we had 8 in a much smaller jurisdiction. But we there's just so much work to do. And in a year like this where we go from March to a May primary to a June runoff to November presidential to a December runoff, it is nonstop. We spend our Christmas together after the runoff. That's how it is. And the fact that we are able to get enough people that have that level of dedication always amazes me. But there are other things that we need funding for to help bring us up to speed, to help get us off of paper and get us automated. So much of what we do has to be in paper, that we have to automate what we can, and we have to move digitally where we can to help prevent issues that could pop up when we're using a paper-based system.
According to a January poll from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, just a slim majority, about 57% of people, said they're confident the election will be conducted fairly. Why do you think trust in the electoral system is so low right now?
I think that, especially here in COP, what I see is, to some people who have been here their whole lives, it feels like COP changed within one election, and that all of a sudden they went from voting one way to voting a different way. And in reality, it was slow change that maybe they didn't see in their neighborhood. Maybe it was in areas like Smyrna that are a little bit more metro. But COP was changing for a while, and then it just became reality in that one election. So I think a little bit of it is fear. I think it's fear that a place that people have known their whole lives has changed. And I think it's uncertainty. You know, whenever we're handed down a new law, a new unfunded mandate, and we have to learn a new process, I always tell people, hey, I have a master's in elections, and I still learn stuff every single day. So to expect the average voter to understand the intricacies of the systems we have in place is not possible. So it's up to us as election administrators to do the best job we can to educate the public and give them the information they need to get them back to the table.
Well, this past December, a court ruled that former Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani must pay Fulton County election workers Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss $148 million in damages. And in a suit brought by Moss and Freeman, Giuliani was found guilty of defamation, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and civil conspiracy. Giuliani and Trump falsely accused the mother and daughter of election fraud and continued to do so even after multiple investigations found those claims to be untrue. Giuliani had previously admitted in court documents that his accusations of fraud were false.
The flame that Giuliani lit with those lies and passed to so many others changed every aspect of our lives. Our homes, our family, our work, our sense of safety, our mental health, and we're still working to rebuild.
That was Shea Moss speaking outside the Federal District Court in Washington in December. Tate, on one hand, you're working to educate voters about the system, the way it works, the security of that system. But you're also talking to people who are hesitant about supporting the work you do to make sure everybody has a chance to cast their ballot. What are the conversations you're having with those folks, the folks who maybe want to serve but are afraid?
I think that they understand the need. You know, we have 148 precincts, and we need at least 11 people per precinct to staff a regular election like this tomorrow. That'll be nice and quiet for us. So they understand the need, and I think that there is that sense of service within the community, like I talked about earlier, that people know that they need to step up, and they know that we're doing the best we can. And I think that they come here. We have all of our training here in our facility, and so I think they come here for training. They see how hard we're working. They see how passionate we are. And it helps them realize that we're all on the same team and that we're all here together and we're doing everything we can, trying to balance security with the implications of having police presence at a polling place is very delicate in a state like Georgia, where historically police presence was an intimidation factor against a group of voters. So how we balance that with making our poll workers feel secure is very delicate. And it's not always easy, but we try and we learn and we move forward. And our poll workers are amazing, amazing advocates for the work we do.
That's Tate Fall, Elections Director for Cobb County, Georgia. Tate, hope everything goes really smoothly tomorrow for you. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Stephen, I wanted to ask you about one particular part of Georgia election law. You know, back in the midterms, we saw thousands and thousands and thousands of challenges to voters on Georgia rolls. Georgia has a law that allows individuals to challenge the vote qualifications of other voters. And the legislature is even trying to open that up more. How big of a factor might that be in 2024 when activists come out to challenge voter rolls and try to kick people off the rolls who they'd rather not vote?
Well, I mean, I think it's a... It's hard to point to any one factor doing things, because on the one hand, you know, Georgia is one of the states that is still involved in something called ERIC, which is this multi-state information sharing compact. So, you know, if I were to move from Atlanta to, say, Virginia, and that information would be passed to both Georgia elections officials and Virginia election officials so that people aren't staying on the rolls where they don't live anymore. So there's a good automated process that complies with federal law to make sure that the voter rolls are clean, like when people pass away or things like that. But these voter challenges basically stem from this idea of, well, that's not good enough. And, you know, the second somebody becomes ineligible to vote, or I think they're ineligible to vote, we need to kick them off the rolls. And so what we saw in the previous elections was a bit of a short circuiting of the process of people bringing mass challenges without the full slate of information to know whether somebody was actually still a registered voter or living there or not. And the biggest symptom or the biggest problem from that, in addition to people being taken off the rolls that didn't realize it and they were still eligible to vote, is it really just bogged down the elections offices. I mean, you know, we just heard from the Cobb County elections director. Every major metro Atlanta county has a different elections director now than they did in 2020. There's a huge brain drain of talented and longtime elections officials gone in Georgia. And even for the ones that are still here, taking the time to research and to send the challenge information and hold hearings for these challenges bogs down the elections offices when they're already overwhelmed with running elections and doing voter registration and preparing for nonstop voting. So that to me is the biggest thing, the biggest negative that's come from these challenges, more so than are there going to be people kicked off the rolls en masse? Because what we've seen is that most of them are rejected because the people bringing these challenges don't have good faith, don't have good cause, and really don't have a good idea of what it means to remove someone from the rolls.
Well, I want to make sure we mention that last year, a federal judge in Atlanta ruled that Georgia needed to redraw its congressional map because it violated the Voting Rights Act. New maps were approved in December ahead of this election. George, what's the effect of those new maps and what's been the reaction to them in Georgia?
So the one that I part of this that I keep coming back to is how the 7th District, that's Lucy McBath's district in Gwinnett, got blown up. Gwinnett is majority non-white. There is no racial majority in Gwinnett County. It is a unique and interesting place for a lot of reasons, which means there's some real value in having a single congressperson who's representing most of it. And now it's cracked into four different places. Cobb County has re-inherited like a Lucy McBath campaign.
And we should just mention that Lucy McBath is the Democratic representative from that district.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think it did a disservice there. I think that's the biggest disservice. But let's be clear, like the state Senate and state House districts are gerrymandered, frankly. There are exactly two competitive state Senate races that are going to happen in this state. I don't even know how competitive they are in a state Senate with 56 members. Nothing like the Republicans in the legislature have done an extraordinarily good job of protecting themselves from political change.
Just as we wrap up here, Todd, what are you watching out of tomorrow's primary in Georgia? We have the presumptive Republican nominee. We know President Biden is the Democratic nominee.
Let's talk about straight politics real quick. We've seen the weaknesses of both of these candidates through the primary so far. We know that Joe Biden has weaknesses on the progressive left, largely because of policy in Israel and Gaza. Donald Trump has shown extraordinary weakness with independents, with women in the suburbs. Atlanta has a lot of women, a lot of independents, and gigantic suburbs. Nikki Haley was in the race before. She's not anymore. So that's the dynamic I'm watching to see where the major weakness is here, if it's bringing able to reach across the MAGA base. He's got them. But what about everybody else?
Well, that's 1A's Todd Zwillick. He joins us each Monday for our new series focused on this election season and the health of our democracy. Also with us today, George Chidi. He's an Atlanta-based politics and democracy reporter for The Guardian, and Stephen Fowler, a political reporter for NPR who covers the Southeast. George, Stephen, and Todd, thanks for being with us. Today's producer was Anna Casey. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing. Visit your local REI co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways to opt outside.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. The Capital One Venture X business card earns unlimited double miles on every purchase. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/VentureXBusiness.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.